Welcome to So You Want to Be a Copywriter, brought to you by the Australian Writers Centre, the world's leading centre for writing courses. Your host is Bernadette Schwert, who you'll find at copyschool.com, and you can find out more about all our copywriting courses at copywritingcourses.com.au. Now, over to Bernadette.
Would you like to add copy editing, project editing, and proofing to your suite of services? If so, then this episode is for you. Matt Davies is a leading copy editor. He specializes in the healthcare and government sector and has created a thriving business that lets him work on his terms so that he has the time and space to pursue his true passion, which is writing novels. He's already written three and he's just going from strength to strength. In this episode, Matt outlines what a copy editor does, how to upskill so you can offer the service to your clients, how to collaborate with others on large-scale projects like Royal Commissions, how to work with web usability and accessibility guidelines, and here's one for the novelists. He also covers how to write your first chapter to hook those all-important publishers. Hello, I'm Bernadette Schwert. I'm the founder of the Australian School of Copywriting and the head copywriting tutor at the Australian Writers' Centre. If you'd like to learn how to upskill and become a professional copywriter, why not do one of our courses? They're short, they're sharp, they're shiny, and give you the skills, templates, and confidence to offer copywriting as a service. A short course can make a big impact. Here's a review from Dan, who recently completed one of our courses. He said, "I've been an editor for many years, but wanted to extend my services to copywriting. I could write, but I didn't know exactly how to write copy. I did the course and now have the confidence to write for a range of different mediums. I feel like I've future-proofed my business as I can now go back to my existing clients and offer them copywriting as well as editing. I've doubled my income without needing to find any new clients." Well done, Dan. To find out more about our courses, you can visit writerscentre.com.au/essentials or copyschool.com. And if you like our podcasts, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Let's get started. Matt Davies, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Bernadette. Thanks so much for having me.
My absolute pleasure. And Matt, I have to tell everyone how we met. Is that okay with you?
Yes, that's fine.
Well, Matt and I go to the same gym. And I was rowing. He was rowing. We got partnered up together. We got chatting. And he said, "He writes books." I said, "So do I." He says, "Who do you write them for?" I said, "So do I." So we wrote for the same organisation. And then we discovered we had tons in common. We knew lots of people in common as well. So ever since then, we kind of work out together, not officially or exclusively, but we have a bit of fun, don't we, Matt?
Yeah, it's fun. It's fun. I like the way our gym works. I like the way that it partners you up with people and you get to meet new people and work with people you like as well. And I like the way it's sort of structured and the way that it pushes you. Because, I wouldn't be doing half that stuff if I was on my own, I can tell you.
I totally agree. And the fact I've got you to talk to, it kind of takes the attention away from the hurt of the cardio, doesn't it? So it's really nice to get distracted. And also just having someone to talk to while you're walking, you know, while you're working. So it was really uncanny that we have so much in common, and I thought it'd be fantastic to actually get you on the podcast because we're in the same business. Different elements and the way we do it is different, but we've got lots in common. Yeah. So first up, tell us about the difference between copywriting, copy editing, and proofreading. I think they sometimes get lumped into all of one and the same, but let's talk through what are the differences specifically.
Yeah, they do get lumped in, but they are definitely different skills. But they're really three steps in the same process of creating a document or web content or a manuscript, anything that's going to be published, really. And ideally, they're done by different people. Copywriting, as your listeners would know, is about, I guess, responding to a client brief and writing something from scratch. The second step would then be having that copy edited by a professional editor. What the editor does will depend on the brief. Most of my work is editing, and for me, I'm usually editing material that's been developed by policy writers or doctors, or because I work a lot in the health sector, or subject matter experts. Often these documents have been cobbled together by multiple authors. So there's often a lot of work to be done to bring them together and make it a sort of cohesive document. In the sort of biggest sense, the brief might call for a structural edit where you're moving stuff around to where it makes the most logical sense flow-wise. Or it might be more of a line edit because the material's already been approved by, the organization's executive, or a minister's office, if it's a government document, and they just want to improve the readability, making sure it's presented in plain English, and obviously also making sure that it's all technically correct in terms of grammar and things like that. Proofreading is the last stage, usually after a document or manuscript has been laid out by a graphic designer or it's been typeset. If the document has been professionally edited, this stage shouldn't really result in a lot of change. It should be about checking for typos, yes, but in a document that's going to be printed, especially, it's also about making sure, for example, that the table of contents matches the actual internal content, that each page is numbered, little things like that, making sure new chapters start on the right-hand page if that's the style of the document. There are no words orphaned at the bottom of a page or the bottom of a paragraph, kind of that sort of thing. Those last-minute little technical checks, I guess. Yeah, but as I said, they're all require different skills.
Yeah. Let's just talk through some of the actual projects you've worked on so people can picture in their mind's eye exactly what you do. Because I think once you speak about that, your role becomes a lot clearer. So just talk us through the scope of projects that you work on.
Well, I work a lot in the health sector, and that covers a variety of things. So I work with health organisations like Beyond Blue and the Cancer Council and government, so health departments. And I work with hospitals and health services. I also edit university textbooks, medical textbooks, nursing textbooks. So that's a specific type of work because you're looking after the whole book. So you're sort of kind of like, I think they call it, what do they call it? Project editing. So you're looking after the whole book, and you work with the authors because there's always multiple authors in these medical textbooks, and going back and forth with them. And then it gets typeset and you're responsible for checking. Then it goes to a proofreader and back to the authors, and you've got to collate the changes between the suggested changes between the proofreader and the authors, create a style guide for the project, and then you've got to sort of be the one who approves it at the end. So that's another thing. And the other thing I do is I do script writing for health online health projects or training videos, educational videos, awareness raising, that sort of stuff. So I guess mostly now I'm not creating a lot of content. It's usually working with other people's material, in all three of those cases. But there's a good mix between the three that th those three different types of work that I do. But occasionally I'll still, develop copy for a website or write something from scratch. Or if I'm editing a document, I might be asked to write an executive summary or something like that to encapsulate the whole document in a few pages, things like that. But mostly it's editing.
Really broad, Matt. And I know from our
Yeah.
chats how much knowledge you have to have and how much knowledge you actually acquire by doing this. You become an absolute expert on some of these very niche topics. So just talk us through your background. What led you to this? How did you become the expert in this particular field?
Well, I started out working in video production because that's what I thought I wanted to do. And the organization I worked for, the production company I worked for, they had a lot of health clients, mostly pharmaceutical companies, but also not-for-profits and things like that. It was just their sort of specialist area. And over the years that I was with them, they really morphed into a healthcare advertising agency. That's what they did. But I was coming in at the end of those projects in the sense that, they had a communication need. They might have had an agency or an internal group or someone who decides, okay, these are the products we need, or this is what we need to do to sell this new therapy or whatever it is. And so I was coming on the in at the end to produce video content, but Sometimes I was thinking, I don't know if the video is actually what you want to do here. I don't know if this is actually the best way to go about this. So I wanted to come in earlier. So I moved into a role with the Victorian Health Department. It's changed names lots of different times over the years, but it was the Department of Human Services then. And so I was doing all different types of communication stuff. So writing communication strategies, doing advertising campaigns, market research, public relations, a whole bunch of stuff. So that was really, really broad. And then when I decided I wanted to go out on my own as a freelancer, I did. So I started that in 2006, and at that point I did one piece of marketing. I don't think I've done anything ever since. And that was to send out my resume to a whole lot of publishers and organization health related organizations and other organizations. And because my background is in health, the publishers that do health work kind of contacted me, and that's how I started doing the textbooks. And it's just word of mouth. It's been word of mouth the whole time. And a hospital will contact the Department of Health and say, "Do you know any editors?" And they'll give them my name. And I mean, occasionally someone will move, a comms manager or someone will move to another organization, like another organization in transport or in finance or something. And they'll contact me, and sometimes I'll take the work on, sometimes I won't, because I'm pretty comfortable in health and I know the Victorian health system very well. So it's kind of easy for me in the sense that I don't have to look up stuff all the time. And with the and with the textbooks, I'm not medically trained, but I certainly have a basic knowledge that helps me a lot in terms of not having. I mean, it's not my job to. They have technical people who check that, that all the claims made are correct and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, I guess it's become a comfortable area for me, rather than doing all, a whole. All different types of subject matter. I'm focusing mainly on health.
So, if you were on a plane and there was an emergency and somebody said, "Is there a doctor on board?" Do you feel confident putting your hand up?
Well, I would help because I'm first aid trained, only because I did the first aid at my son's footy games for years and years and years and years. So I've got first aid, so I probably would step in and help, but I certainly wouldn't be able to diagnose anybody.
You probably know more than you think, actually. And look, Matt,
I do. I'll say, "Oh, I think you've got this. I know how to spell that. I don't know what it is, but I can spell it for you."
And there's a widow there just on the end. Well, she might be a widow if this guy doesn't come through. So tell me about you're more than just an editor, you're a novelist as well, and a successful published novelist. Talk us through your latest novel.
Well, the latest one is called The Broken Wave, and it's thank you for asking, by the way. And it's my yeah, it's my third one, and it just came out at the end of 2023. And it's about an American writer, actually, who comes to the real Victorian seaside town of Queenscliff for the funeral of a childhood friend called Tom. So this American writer's name is Drew, and Tom and Drew were friends briefly as 12-year-olds when they both lived in Queenscliff together. But then something happens, a kind of catastrophic event involving these two boys, and Drew has to go back to the US. So that was 1992. Now it's 2018, and Tom has died, and Drew comes back to Queenscliff, obviously for the funeral, but really it's to try to work through this trauma that he's never really dealt with, and also to find out whether it has anything to do with Tom's death. So I've this book and my previous book, there's a lot of kind of childhood trauma, mental health issues, and that's really come out of the work I've been doing in editing, because there's so much material that I work on to do with mental health. And I worked on the Royal Commission, the report from the Royal Commission into Victoria's mental health system a few years ago. And some of the stories, reading through some of the witness testimony about how the system has let them down and let their family members down, and that can have catastrophic outcomes for people. And yeah, I just it's kind of important to me. I want to talk about it, and I want other people to talk about it, because there is still a stigma around these types of things, and there shouldn't be. So that sort of stuff feeds a lot into my creative work.
Amazing. And talk us through some of the, like we talked at the gym just the other day about writing first chapters. So it's a little bit outside of the sort of the proofing, copy editing sort of topic, but I'm really interested in, because people listening to this will be copywriters, but also potentially novelists, and you are delivering keynotes and training on how to write your first chapter. So just talk us through, the top five things people need to consider when they're writing their first chapter.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm doing a, as you said, I'm delivering a workshop on this in next month, actually, and I've just sort of started to write it. And it's kind of the thing that you don't, the kind of thing you don't sort of think about that much until you have to sit down and tell someone else how you do it. And so it's been, I've started to pull together some stuff now, and it's really interesting just thinking about all the things that you really need to do to grab a reader's attention in a very short period of time, especially if you're a debut novelist. I mean, you've got to grab the attention, first of all, of an agent or a publisher to get interested in reading your material because they get so many submissions. And then if you are lucky enough to get published, then to attract readers, often they'll turn to the first couple of pages and start reading. So and there's lots of ways to do that, and it's so much of it is about voice and tone and all these things that are so hard to teach, and really grabbing the reader from the first page. But it's one of those things that the more you do it, the more instinctive it becomes. But it's interesting to sit down and actually start thinking about, okay, what are those things that grab the reader? You need to, they need to sort of identify in some way or sympathize in some way with your main character, from the very beginning. Even if they're in a, even if they're starting in a dire situation, perhaps they, for example, have hope that they're going to be better. So that holds the reader on just to keep going a bit more. And often starting in action is a very good way to grab people. I mean, there's nothing boring than opening a book and starting to read. It's like one of these 19th century novels. They used to be able to get away with all this backstory and setup and all this stuff, sort of stuff at the beginning before they got into the story. But you can't do that now. You have to weave that in. It's got to be there, but you've really got to weave it in with action and movement to keep the reader's interest. So, it's interesting. It's been an interesting process to go through.
Yeah, I love it. And talk us through maybe your schedule. Like, how do you work on a novel and run a business as an editor? Any tips for people who do want to write a novel, but have also got a writing business as well? Because I imagine there's a strong pull to keep doing income producing things. We know that writing a novel is not necessarily income producing. So how do you balance that, and what strategies would you give to people who want to do both?
That's exactly the tension that you've just mentioned there is that that thing between getting the paid work done and meeting your deadlines and then doing your creative work. And for me, I mean, I've only about once had a deadline. So I've had three novels published. The first one was just I worked on it for ages and ages and sent it out and got rejections and sent it out and got rejections and finally got a publisher. I had a writing group, so I would go through, it would go through my writing group. Same with the second one because it was a different genre. I had to go through to had to find a different publisher, and so I went through that whole process again. But then with this third one that's just come out, I had a two book deal with this publisher, so I had a year to write it, which I've never had a deadline like that. And at the beginning, I was really worried about it, but and it didn't sort of, I hoped to get it finished earlier and had some more time to write on it, but it didn't work out that way. But I delivered it on time. But yeah, having the deadline was really good for me. So now again, I'm in this situation where I don't have a contract, so it's really only me. I have to make the time myself. I have to prioritize it. Whether that's, getting up in the morning and doing a couple of hours, whether it's, not watching TV for a few months, or whatever it is, because no one else is going to write it for you, and no one's waiting for it. So unless I sit down in the chair and do it, it's not going to happen. So that's kind of my motivation when I think about Where do I want to be in 10 years' time? Do I still want to be editing other people's work, or do I want to be making more of my living off my own creative work? And I know what the answer to that question is. So that means I have to do the work. Otherwise, there's nothing to publish, there's nothing to promote, there's nothing to make money off if I don't sit down and do the work. So yeah, I just have to make myself do it. And I'm in a bit of that situation at the moment now, where I've got a lot of paid work on. But it's always in the back of my mind, I need to finish this next manuscript. I need to finish it. So, yeah, it's a tension. It's a tension.
It's good to know that you face that, just because you're published, it doesn't mean it gets any easier. You still have to grapple with those particular tension points. And just to clarify, when you said you know what your goal is, and that is to make more money from your creative work, because you didn't quite
Yes.
make that clear, but that's definitely what you want, right?
Definitely what I want here.
Oh,
I mean, there's not
nice.
that many authors who are making fiction authors who are making a living off their book sales in Australia. I mean, there's a handful, but there's quite a lot who are making a living off their profile as a writer. So the royalties is one thing. I mean, Australia is a very small market. Royalties is one thing, but then there's other things you can do to supplement your income based on your profile as an author. So you can judge writing prizes, you can appear at festivals, you can do library talks, you can mentor other writers. There's lots of other things you can do to make money, school visits, those kinds of things. So but yeah, but I do want to make that more a bigger part of, I mean, I sometimes wonder whether I could write full time. I wouldn't be able to write full time, I don't think, in terms of sitting down every single day, 9 to 5, and it's so mentally taxing. Writing anything is mentally taxing. That's the other reason why I like editing, is because I've got the material there, and it's a different kind of brain work. But yeah, that's definitely the goal.
Yeah, fantastic. Let's get back to the editing side, because people listening are probably thinking they want to do what you're doing, which is have lots of paid work that's really in the world of writing. It's all connected. It informs your novel writing, because if you're doing that all day, you've got to be a better writer because you understand editing, I presume. So talk to me about what are some of the skills or key skills and knowledge required to be an effective copy editor in a range of industries. What do you see as those key skills?
Well, in a general sense, for all copy editing, you need to know the technical aspects of writing. So, syntax and grammar and punctuation. When to use a comma or a semicolon or a colon, how to set up a bullet list correctly, the meanings of words, the difference between continuous and continual. Then there's plain English, so things like how to preference active voice over passive voice, pa passive voice, and getting rid of unnecessary words, choosing simpler phrasing, all these things that organizations are looking for an editor to do for them. I mean, particularly, I mean, I work a lot with government and I work a lot with doctors. So, and both of them, they have a bad reputation for writing sort of verbosely or vaguely, or something like that. And so, for the health sector specifically, it helps to have obviously a bit of a handle on the industry language. Get a lot of American spellings of conditions and biological things, and knowing things like fetal shouldn't have an O, for example, and the correct names of national health programs and health services, so you don't have to be looking them up all the time. It's also very important to use sensitive language in everything, but especially health. So person first language is a big thing, like saying a person with disability as opposed to a disabled person, putting the person first rather than the condition. Using gender neutral terms, firefighter instead of fireman, and things like that. These things are all very important that often, people who are writing this stuff don't think of. And then there's obviously just all that stuff about consistency and making sure that the document sounds like it's been written by one person. And With all that with all copy editing or copywriting, all those things about knowing who your audience is and who you're targeting, all that sort of stuff, and making sure it's suitable for that audience.
Awesome. And I think this is a learnt skill, isn't it? Can someone learn this, or are you particularly disposed from a personal or personality talent-based position? Now, can anyone do this, or what makes a good one versus an
Anyone
average
can,
one?
but I mean, it is everything. I mean, no one's born knowing the difference between a colon and a semicolon, so everything is learnt,
Really?
everything. I mean, obviously there is, good writing, the thing about it, there's a lot of feel and instinct that goes into it. But yeah, I mean, you can definitely learn those technical skills. That's one thing. But I'm definitely suited to it. I like things to be right. And so I think I'm good at it from that perspective, because I'm genuinely interested in making sure that it's things are correct. And in proofreading, I love picking up mistakes, because at that last stage where it's been edited and everyone thinks it's fine, and you go through and then I noticed that, on page 28 they spelt something one way, and on page 120 three, they're spelt in a different way. Those things, I remember those things. And I like with the textbooks, I like that finicky side of referencing and making sure all those references and citations are correct. And that if a claim's been made, about something, 80% of people suffer from X, Y, Z, I want to make sure that that's backed up with evidence and all those kinds of things. And so, yeah, so that suits my personality. It does.
That's good. In another life, do you think you would have been a lawyer or something? Do you ever think what you might have been if you weren't this?
No, I don't know. I mean, I do think about that sometimes, about what else I would do. But I definitely, the creative side of me needs to come out. I do that, and creative people do this in all aspects of their life, whether it's about rearranging their furniture and making, getting throw rugs and bright cushions and making things look nice. That's creativity. Coming up with creative solutions for problems, that's creativity. And I think whatever I do, I mean, you can't help but use your gifts, right? I mean, whatever I did, it would have to have something like that in it. But yeah, there's this other side of me that's particular.
Amazing. So, Matt, talk us through accessibility requirements. I'm quite interested in that because that's obviously something very important in a government document. So, firstly, talk us through what does that actually mean, accessibility requirements, and what kind of considerations do you need to consider?
So, all the documents for the government departments I work with have to be accessible to people with low vision or using screen readers before they can be uploaded to their websites. There are international web content accessibility guidelines that need to be followed. And what this means in practice is making sure, so when the screen reader is going through the document, making sure it makes sense to the reader or the listen person who's listening, I should say. So that's making sure every heading and line of text is assigned a style in, I don't know how familiar you are with Microsoft Word and setting up styles and stuff like that. That headings don't skip from a heading one to a heading four, for example, that all the images and the graphics have alt text, so that text that sits behind the image that you don't see, but it gets read out to the person to explain what the image shows. The tables are set up correctly, so when a person using a screen reader tabs through them, they make logical sense, in terms of, so they can understand what column they're in, what row they're in. So that means no sort of stacking header rows. There only can only be one header row, no merge cells, no empty cells, that kind of thing. So it's technical, but it's important for ensuring that people who have extra needs in terms of accessing government information are not excluded. And yeah, so that's something that I've learned how to do, and that's a service that I offer. And as I said, a lot of my government clients require that, so I'm able to, that's sort of an add-on that I've added on in the last probably 5 years. So that's another kind of string to my bow that I can offer clients.
So are you saying then, Matt, that that is a separate service to the editing that you do, like formatting those documents in that way?
Yes, it is. I bundle them together. So I will usually do that stuff first and do all that formatting stuff first, and then I edit it because then I go through and I because all that formatting stuff, when I edit, I track all the changes. So obviously if I'm moving stuff around and changing things, that's going to get very messy on a page if I'm tracking all that. So usually I'll do all that formatting stuff and make sure it's all correct. And then I'll go through and do the edit, and sometimes I'll pick up some other stuff as I go through that I've missed on the first time around. But yeah, they're separate services, but yeah, increasingly doing them at the same time for certain clients.
So I imagine someone listening who's thinking of becoming an editor or already is an editor, they might like to consider doing a bit more training or whatever it might be to get up to speed on that so that they can actually promote that as an additional reason to pick them as the editor.
Yeah, exactly. And with one government department I work for in particular, they have templates for their documents, because what they used to do is, policy people would write documents in Word, then they'd send it to an editor, the editor would edit it, and then they would send it to a graphic designer, and then they would lay it out, and then they would send it to a printer, and they would print it. This was the old days, and that's very expensive, and especially for the document that people might not really read. So now what they do is they have this particular one I'm talking about is they have templates, and so I work within that template, and I make and those templates are already pretty accessible, but the people who have written the documents have started with that template, and then they've gone in and they've inadvertently stuffed things up because they don't really understand how things work. Like they've merged cells within tables or whatever they've done, which is a no-no. So I do that formatting work, and then it gets published to the web. Usually things aren't printed as much as they used to be. And so that takes out the need, sorry, designers, for the graphic designer. So it's saving the money. So now it's just getting, and plus they're accessible for people who need that accessibility. So the documents are better, it's a cheaper process. It's a win-win for everyone except for the graphic designers, I guess. The higher profile documents still get designed and laid out, but generally they're in templates, so they have the same look and feel all the time, which is a good thing. So yeah, it's saving money, I guess. Our money.
Yes, the taxpayer, exactly.
Yes.
So your funds at work. So Matt, tell me about collaboration because you obviously work with multiple people, multiple platforms. Talk us through some of the strategies, or firstly, some of the conflicts or challenges that might arise, and then strategies for minimizing those particular issues that might crop up.
Do you mean working with other editors or with different clients, or
Oh, maybe with other editors. I mean, whatever you feel is most pressing for you, what do you find most of?
well, I mostly work alone, but once or twice a year I'll work on a huge project like the final report of a Royal Commission, that are often massive and have short turnaround times, requiring the skills of multiple copy editors and proofreaders. So in these situations, communication with each other is really important, but what's most important is having a style guide for the project, so that everyone is on the same page. Because when you've got different editors and then different proofreaders, there's a danger that, the consistency will fall away. So this style guide will be a document that covers things particular to that publication, like how many lines does a quote need to be before it becomes a block quote? Is healthcare one word or two? Do we say Australian government or federal government or Commonwealth government? Let's pick one and be consistent. Do we say healthcare practitioner or health professional, or healthcare professional, let's pick one term and use it consistently throughout the whole document. So when you have multiple copy editors working on a project, that consistency is really key. In terms of collaborating with clients, I guess one of the big things for me is that I don't tend to push issues. So I advise, I present clients with pros and cons, I tell them what's best practice, and then I let them make the decisions. It's their documents or their book, it's got their name on it or their organization's name on it. Look, as long as it's consistent within itself, I leave editing decisions ultimately up to them. You know, as I said before, I track all my suggested changes, but if they don't want to accept them, it's out of my hands. And often I don't see documents after they're published. You know, like I'll be sent an annual report, for example. I'll edit it, track all my changes, send it back, and then I get a note back saying, "Yep, thanks very much. That was really valuable. Send us your bill." So if they don't accept half of them, I don't know, and I don't care really. I mean, it's really up to them. But those, yeah, again, you know, those style guides and everyone being on the same page is really important, because that sort of gives you a bit of an argument with clients as well. If their organization has a style guide and they say, "Well, we want to do, you know, we want to capitalize, you know, student manager and occupational therapist," and I'll say, "Well, one, there's no grammatical reason to do that, but and two, it's in your style guide that you don't do that. So up to you, but I'm just telling you." As long as you, if you want to capitalize occupational therapist all the way through your document, make sure you do it all the way through the document. Don't just do it once or twice and, you know, here and there, but you don't need to really.
Matt, what are some of the ways in which you keep up to date with trends in style guides and what's appropriate and what's not?
I am sort of on top of this because I'm forced to. Like, if I want to work for some of those more progressive government departments as a contractor, I have to be across all that stuff. As I mentioned, there are web content accessibility guidelines. But as for the copywriting stuff, I use the Australian government's free online style manual as my guide. They used to be a print guide, but now it's online, and it covers everything you would need to know about writing in the Australian context, I guess. And it's even things like, you know, how to refer to Acts of Parliament, or to government ministers, prime ministers. You know, how do you, what how do, when do you use the honourable, and when do you how do you refer to royalty and things like that. But then it also covers, like a style guide usually does, about referencing and plain language and grammar and best practice in pretty much everything. When to use italics, when to set something in bold. When you want to, like, for example, if you're wondering, what do I do about the name of a ship? And the names of ships are always in italics. So you can just go to that style guide and you can just put in the search bar ships, and it'll come up and it'll give you advice on how you refer to ships. I mean, I'm pretty familiar with it. It's extensive. It's got a lot of stuff in there, but it's really worth getting your head around. And even if you just use it to check in and use that search bar, if you wanted to double check something, because things have changed. Like in the previous published edition, for example, when talking about Acts of Parliament, the abbreviation was for section was an S with a full stop, but now they don't want the full stop. You used to have to spell numbers. All single digit numbers spell out, and then just use, you know, the numerals after that. But now it's just number one and everything else, because, you know, writing is so concise now, and web and all that sort of stuff. Just use the number two, use the number three. So those kind of things change. And you know, a lot of organizations, the bigger organizations, do have style guides, but as a default, I use that, the government style manual, and also Macquarie Dictionary is the dictionary, the Australian dictionary that I use to check spellings and things like that.
That's really handy. That's awesome. Yeah. So, Matt, in wrapping up, what do you envisage as some of the future trends and developments in copy editing in the context of, you know,
Well, I
technology
think
and
that
communication
focus on
channels?
plain language that we've been
Yeah.
talking about, I think, is really going to get more pronounced, and, you know, being concise. I mean, so much of our communication is online now. So we have to be brief, layouts have to be clear. We need white space to give the readers eyes and brains and breathing room. You know, these are all, that's formatting stuff is, you know, something you need to think about as well, about how you set out a document. You know, breaking things into paragraphs rather than having big chunks and all those types of things. I think there'll be more emphasis on making sure documents are as accessible as possible to people, as we were talking about. So again, that's about plain language, but also meeting those web content accessibility guidelines, so more of our population can access your document. In terms of AI, which is something I know you guys you talk about a lot on this podcast, it's amazing what technology like chat GPT can do if you give it a clear brief, and that stuff's only going to get better. I've never used it to copy edit document, particularly because I have to track all my changes, as I said, and I'm working with particular style guides, so I couldn't really get away with it, but it will happen. I'm sure in the future you'll be able to tell an AI program to edit a document in plain language using Australian English, following the Australian style manual, because there's a government style manual. And then, maybe I'll be out of a job. I know you've covered this a lot, and it's not all doom and gloom. It's for all the reasons that you talked about before. But yeah, it's an interesting area, and that's going to become a bigger part of our industry for sure.
Matt, thank you so much for talking to me today. It's been an absolute delight, and I'll see you at the gym.
No problem. Thanks for having me. See you, Bernadette.
Becoming a copy editor or proofreader may not suit everyone, but if you have an eye for detail and enjoy helping others restructure their work so that it's more easily accessible and fits all the guidelines, then it may be a skill set worth exploring. My joke of the day, because I know you're waiting for it. I'm writing a book on reverse psychology. Please don't buy it. And my quote of the day, which is really pertinent to what Matt talked about how he finds the time to write his novels. No matter how slow you're going, you're lapping everyone on the couch. And that's it from me. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to So You Want to Be a Copywriter. You'll find the show notes at soyouwanttobeacopywriter.com.au. This podcast was brought to you by the Australian Writer Centre. Do you want to get started as a professional copywriter? Have a look at our course, Copywriting Essentials. Created by Bernadette Schwert, this 5-week online course will teach you how to write words that sell and get paid to be creative. Find out more at writercentre.com.au/copywriting. And thanks for listening to So You Want to Be a Copywriter. You'll find the show notes at soyouwanttobeacopywriter.com.au.